I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Trump joined dozens of world leaders at a ceremony in Paris to remember the fallen soldiers of World War I. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman was there.
This is all tied, of course, to the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, exactly 100 years past that moment when the armistice was declared. It was not a surrender of the Germans, but rather a halt to the fighting after 4 years of just what had been an unprecedented bloody battle across the Western Front of Europe. And it was a moment of great relief. And 100 years later, it is being remembered here at the Arc de Triomphe. We have dozens of world leaders here, including President Trump, under a rainy sky.
VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman in Paris. In the news, firefighters in the U.S. state of California hope for a break in seasonal winds that would give them a chance to gain ground against wildfires that have killed 23 people so far. Daryl Osby is the Los Angeles County Fire Chief.
We do have a low in weather today, but our weather projections are that starting tomorrow through Tuesday, we'll get another Santa Ana wind event.
In all, thousands of homes have been destroyed. 250,000 people have been forced to evacuate throughout California. An outbreak of Ebola in the eastern region of the Democratic Republic of Congo has killed more than 200 people. The outbreak is in a conflict zone where dozens of armed groups operate. Aid agencies have been forced to suspend or slow down their work on several occasions since the recent outbreak. Ebola was detected in a DRC in 1976, the current outbreak. It is the 10th since it was first discovered. This is VOA News. Heavy rains caused a mudslide near Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, killing 10, injuring 11, and leaving at least 4 missing. Landslides and floods are common there, often affecting poor communities where dwellings are built on steep, unstable hillsides. Rescuers continue to look for survivors and victims. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says he has shared a recording of the death of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi with Britain, France, Germany, Saudi Arabia, and the United States. Reuters' Anna Bevan reports.
Tayyip Erdogan sought to maintain international pressure on Riyadh over the Saudi journalist's death.
They have listened to all the conversations in them. They know there is no need to distort this issue. They know for certain that the killer or the killers is among these 15 people.
Khashoggi, a critic of de facto Saudi ruler Prince Mohammed bin Salman, was killed in Saudi Arabia's Istanbul consulate last month. Erdogan said the hit was ordered at the highest levels of the Saudi government, something it denies.
Reuters' Anna Bevan reporting. The U.S. state of Florida is holding a machine recount of votes in its close races for the U.S. Senate and governor, with results due by Thursday afternoon. In Florida's election for the Senate, Republican Rick Scott has seen his lead shrink over incumbent Democrat Bill Nelson. Close watch is being kept on the recount in a key region. Eugene Pettis is counsel for the Broward County Supervisor of Elections.
There have been allegations of fraud. Those are serious charges to recklessly offer out there. There's no basis for it. To give a claim of fraud without any evidence, I think is unacceptable.
In the gubernatorial contest, unofficial results show Republican Ron DeSantis lead over Democrat Andrew Gillum, slimming. The two Florida contests, along with those for governor in Georgia and U.S. Senate in Arizona, are the most high-profile races still undecided after Tuesday's U.S. congressional elections. Facebook says it's dropping a requirement that forced workers to agree to mandatory arbitration of sexual misconduct allegations.
Many companies make workers sign agreements that they'll go through an arbitrator instead of suing. But recently, technology workers in Silicon Valley have been protesting that policy. Google has also eliminated the arbitration requirement for sexual misconduct complaints after thousands of its employees staged a walkout. Private arbitration allows misconduct allegations to remain secret, sometimes allowing abusers to continue that behavior. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington.
The person that is supposed to be blamed is the president himself for having failed to delegate duties to an office which runs on taxpayers' money.
Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika rejects criticisms that his recent cabinet reshuffle is illegitimate.
Many people want the ballot paper to be introduced, but others also want the marble system to be in place because you don't need to. This country has been using the same marbles for many, many elections.
The Gambian Constitution Review Commission steps up efforts to garner views from citizens about a new constitution.
When you consider the war in Africa, it is, I'm afraid, very depressing. It's very depressing contemplating its impact in Europe and what was to come.
And today marks exactly 100 years since the armistice ending World War I. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika has rejected criticisms that his recent cabinet reshuffle is illegal. The critics say the exclusion of Vice President Saulos Chilima in the list of new cabinet ministers undermines the constitution. Traditionally, the vice president is a prominent member of cabinet. For the latest development regarding the controversy surrounding the president's new cabinet, I read Vincent Kondwe, a governance consultant and a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi.
The president has got a right to express his personal political opinions, but if those opinions are not in consonance with the provisions of the constitution, then those opinions are invalid, illegal, and should not be taken seriously. Because the president is legally out of order. So maybe in the absence of a legally binding statement that he could have said and which he could have made sense, the president just decided to say what he wanted to say out of lack of proper ways, legally speaking. So the criticism that is coming from the president has got no basis at all. What is clear is that the cabinet is illegal. You can't leave out a constitutionally member of the cabinet out of that cabinet.
Vincent, the president argues that a cabinet position is not an honorary position or as a matter of constitutional status, but the subscription to the policies of the government of the day, basically referring to the vice president not subscribing to the policies of his administration and thereby accusing the administration of being corrupt.
Yes, the principle of cabinet collective responsibility dictates like that. But here, we should differentiate the political disagreements between the president and his vice, and the constitutional provisions of how the vice president is elected, and the very same constitution provides that the vice president shall be a member of the cabinet. So out of political expediency, the president is politically right and correct, but at no point in time does the constitution give the president the power to choose when the constitution should be operationalized or not. So the president does not have the mandate to suspend the provisions of the constitution. So as it stands, whatever he says is illegal and has got no legal grounding.
There's a situation where the president basically refers to the vice president as someone. Has the relationship between the two gentlemen deteriorated to the extent that they can't mention each other's name? And then you have the vice president saying that the DPP cannot accuse him of being ungrateful since he participated fully and that without him, the president wouldn't have been elected into office in the first place.
You see, the vice president is not the vice president of the ruling DPP. He is an elected state vice president. He is the vice president of the country. So if they disagree at a political party level, it does not mean that that disagreement nullifies the election of the vice president. No, it does not. So the DPP should leave out political party differences from state matters. And then on the issue of the vice president saying the DPP should not press on him because he was one of the members of the people who was instrumental in making sure that the DPP was elected in 2014. We may not know to what extent the vice president is saying the truth, because he joined the DPP about 9 to 8 months away from the election day in 2014. So that statement, for me, I take it with a pinch of salt, because within those 9 months, the party has been preparing since the death of its founder, Bindu Mutharika, in 2012. They have been preparing for those elections in 2014.
The vice president has repeatedly accused the administration, of which he is part of being corrupt, and has demanded an investigation into all state institutions. His critics say he's receiving pay monthly, yet not working. So isn't he corrupt himself? They ask.
No. The vice presidency in Malawi is a delegated office. So it's at the discretion of the president to delegate duties to his deputy. Now, in this case, the president has chosen not to delegate state matters to an elected state president at his own volition. So you don't blame someone who is supposed to work under delegated powers. So in fact, the person that is supposed to be blamed is the president himself for having failed to delegate duties to an office which runs on taxpayers' money.
Vincent Kondwe is a governance consultant and a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. The Gambian Constitution Review Commission has stepped up efforts to garner views of citizens across the country. This, members of the country say, would help with the mandate to include their views in a new constitution. Some Gambians say there's need for term limits to prevent a head of state from staying in power for more than 2 full 5-year terms. For more about the latest political development, I reach Omar Wali, an independent journalist based in the Gambian capital, Banjul.
Constitutional Review Commission has been mandated to draft a new constitution and to review the 1997 constitution as well. So they have been given 18 months to draft and present a new constitution. So in doing that, they began a nationwide consultation and asking people, what do they want to see in the new constitution? Some are saying they want a term limit. Gambia doesn't have a term limit. Some are saying they want 50 plus 1%. We have a single majority. Even if you lead a candidate in one vote, the person will be president, unlike other countries in Africa. And others also are saying they want the chairman of the Electoral Commission should not be appointed by the president, but be elected. And so these are some of the issues that people are talking about. Generated debate among many Gambians has to do...
A lot of Africans have been talking about this issue when it comes to the LGBTQ issue, or homosexuality, as some say in the Gambia. What has been the response so far with this, about instituting it possibly in the next constitution?
Well, I can say almost everybody in this country is opposing the homosexuality to be in the new constitution. So both the Muslims and the Christians, and we have only few non-believers. But people are not even talking about LGBT in this country. So everybody is totally against it. They said it's against religion, like both in Islam and the Christianity.
But some supporters say that why should people be concerned about what 2 consenting adults do in their bedroom? And they are questioning why their rights should be taken away from them when heterosexuals are allowed to do whatever they want without anybody judging them.
The belief among many people in this country is that this is not African and this is against their belief, both Muslims and Christians. And they said it is something that emanated from somewhere. and they want to impose it on them. When you talk to most people, they will be like, they know marriage is between man and a woman, not two men or two women. So that is the argument here. So that's why they are totally opposing this homosexuality.
Talking about the election, the leader of the Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction, or APRC, led by the former president of the Gambia, Yahya Jammeh, is saying that not only life in the country being difficult under President Adama Barrow than it was in Yahya Jammeh's time, and that the election that Yahya Jammeh lost was rigged. Talk to me about that.
That was what led to the political impasse in this country from 2016 to the January 2017. Jammeh was defeated and he conceded defeat, but there were some errors in the electoral results. But that even put Jammeh ahead of his opponents in certain part. But after that, they lead Jammeh over tens of thousands of votes. Jammeh conceded defeat, but when the IEC came, that is the electoral body, said they made some errors. Jammeh used that and said he was not going to accept the results, and he nullified the election, and he said the IEC should organize a new election. That led plunge this country into a political impasse, which forced the ECOWAS leaders to form flush Jammeh out of this country. But still now, 2 years into Barrow's presidency, the former ruling party insisted that the elections were not credible, the electoral officials are not God-fearing, and both the IEC chairman is challenging them to come with proofs that the elections were rigged by the chairman.
What did he mean by the electoral commission officials were not God-fearing?
The interim leader of the party was echoing remarks made by the former President Jammeh, who, after nullifying the results, said they were not God-fearing. And before accepting the results, before he went up for nomination, Jammeh said, Gambia election is rigged-proofed. He said, nobody can rig Gambia's election, because this country doesn't use a ballot paper. They use a marbles, where he's the only electoral commission that have access to it, and they only one person to a vote. It cannot be duplicated. So Jammeh was just using that as a pretext to justify that the election, because he was never expecting to lose election.
Are the Gambians considering changing the way of voting by using the stones and the bucket instead of the, people say, the paper ballot that a lot of African countries have been using?
Well, many people want the ballot paper to be introduced, but others also want the marble system to be in place, because this country has been using the same marbles for many, many elections. Whenever there's election, you don't change them, you keep them, and if you need more, they will go to other countries and they bring more. So unlike using ballot papers, it's too expensive, because every election, be it presidential or parliamentary, mayoral or local government election, they have to go and print new ballot papers. But with these ones, they are colorless. You can always use them. Elections, open elections. So since the independence, this is what the governments have been using. And most people want that system to continue, because it's more transparent, it's cost effective.
Omar Wale is an independent Gambian journalist. He spoke with me from Banjul. The first ever beauty contest for albinos was held in the Ugandan capital Kampala Saturday. Organizers say the event provided a platform and opportunity for albinos to demonstrate their talents for them to be recognized. 5 men and 5 women were chosen by judges to represent Uganda at the Mr. and Miss East Africa's beauty contest, scheduled to be held in the Kenyan capital Nairobi at the end of November. For more, I reach Michelle Omam Teker, Executive Director of the Malengo Foundation, who was a judge at the event.
The significance is indescribable. Social inclusion is the foundation of all structures of inclusive development in Africa, which I think that not many people realize. It is just as important to empower persons with disabilities to be confident, as it is important to empower non-disabled people to include persons with disabilities and persons with albinism. So I think that this platform was really great in this aspect of fostering that duality between empowering persons with albinism, changing the narrative to be a narrative of beauty, to be a narrative of acceptance, and really giving a platform where non-disabled and of persons without albinism can look at themselves and say, do we really view persons with albinism as beautiful? And if we don't, then the time is now to start.
How was the response from Ugandans and across East Africa?
I would say, personally, being at the event, I think the response was really wonderful. I mean, it was aired on so many media platforms and so many people, even at the event. The participants themselves were glowing. You know, it was really evident that it was a platform that they yearned for. The albinism community, specifically the youth, were yearning for a platform that surrounded beauty and acceptance. And I think it was really warmly received. I think everybody left the event lifted. I think it was very well organized and very well executed. And I believe that it was, you know, the step in the right direction, being the first event.
With this event, despite being a judge, did you see this as part of the effort to educate Ugandans about albinism and other people living with disabilities?
Yes. I did. I firmly think so, because all the work that the Lengu Foundation does specifically, majorly our work is around social rights and social acceptance. And I think that using beauty, because we use fashion a lot in our activism, and I think using a beauty pageant, really beauty pageant winners are ambassadors in the sense of their role models in society for all people to look up to, regardless of whether a person has albinism or not. When we say this is Miss Albinism or this is Mr. Albinism, everybody is going to look at this person as a symbol of beauty. And we, as the judges, me and we were three judges in total, we really took it upon ourselves to choose contestants who would compete then at the regional finals in Nairobi, really looking at choosing young girls and young boys who, if they won the overall East Africa regional crown, would be role models to all people, regardless of whether they had albinism.
I understand the Malengo Foundation organizes a host of events where people who are living with different kinds of challenges, as well as able-bodied people, all participate in some of these events. Talk to me about this East African event that Malengo Foundation often organizes.
Malengo Foundation actually is an organization that propagates the Sustainable Development Goals. And to young people, we find creative ways to do that. And our goal, our specific goal of choice is Goal 10, Global Goal 10 for Reduced Inequalities. And we run on the target to promote the social and economic inclusion of all persons, regardless of disability and economic background. The platform we use is fashion. It's the hot pink catwalk fashion show is the event that we are most popularly known for. In our lineup of events. It happens annually, and it always happens in October because this is the United Nations Awareness Month in Uganda. So what we have is that we have a fashion show that has that is inclusive at all points. So on the runway, we have persons that use across all abilities. So we have the blind, we have those with albinism, we have non-disabled, wheelchair users, little people, people with invisible disabilities, intellectual disabilities, developmental disabilities, and so forth. So we get all the top designers in Uganda to participate for a good cause at this event.
Michelle Omamteka is the executive director of the Malengo Foundation in Uganda. She spoke with me from Kampala. Today marks exactly 100 years since the armistice ending World War I, a global conflict in which 16 million soldiers and 21 million civilians died. When most Westerners think of that conflict, they imagine British, American, Portuguese, and German soldiers bogged down in the muddy, rat-infested trenches of Europe. However, the First World War also raged in Africa, where over a million Africans served as soldiers and porters for the colonial forces of Great Britain, Belgium, Portugal, and Germany.
To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with the English historian Edward Pays, author of Tip and Run, The Untold Tragedy of the Great War in Africa.
When World War I broke out in August 1914, most believed it would be over by year's end. The Africans who signed up to fight with the colonial forces were volunteers. And while some carriers were hired to move food and materiel from place to place, animals did most of the work. However, historian Edward Pace says that as the war widened, most animals ended up dying from disease. And in 1916, the colonial powers forced Africans to serve as carriers.
And the sort of conditions that they had to do their job under were absolutely horrendous. They were paid a pittance, they were away from home for months on end with inadequate rations in extremes of heat and cold, carrying enormously heavy loads. But these were not usually in neat bundles. These were things like the wheel to a piece of artillery or something like that. Really unimaginably tough work. And the constant threat of disease, whether it was malaria or dysentery, and in a medical establishment that was unable to keep up with all the requirements. So for most of the regiments involved, say on the British side, whether they were from Ghana, Nigeria, or Kenya, most of the deaths are due to disease rather than in battle.
Indeed, Africans suffered 90% of the war's casualties. Of the estimated 1 million carriers who served on the British side, over 100,000 perished. And Pace says that those who did survive were treated very differently than the Germans treated theirs.
The British administration at least attempted to keep records of all the carriers that were taken on. They were paid a nominal amount. On the German side, people were just conscripted without payment and were treated as utterly expendable.
Yet, says Pace, it was Africans who did most of the fighting.
You have European officers, but it was a war fought by Africans under European direction. In terms of how they performed, records of extraordinary valour on both sides are legion. I mean, you can ask the question of why, when these troops were fighting for European powers, but that is a separate question.
Still, powerful echoes remained.
As far as remembrance is concerned, I have no doubt that when soldiers and carriers returned, obviously their experiences would have been related and have remained within communities. But that is not recorded in history books because, by and large, societies caught up in the biggest theatre of fighting in East Africa, most were non-literate. And so, you know, nobody was setting down their experiences in writing, and nobody in the colonial administration was going to go and collect these memories.
Pace also recalls the agony of those who stayed behind. As troops moved back and forth within the theatres of war, subsistence farms were stripped to feed the troops, causing widespread famine, especially in German-held territories such as present-day Tanzania. Add to this the Spanish flu epidemic, which began just 1 month before the war ended. It spread rapidly along supply and communications lines, some thousands of kilometers long. In what is now Kenya, an estimated 200,000 people, one-tenth of the population, succumbed to influenza.
And that is a greater loss of life than occurred as a result of the war itself. So, yes, it is the final, almost apocalyptic occurrence in October 1918.
Historian Edward Pace says the post-war period was also grim.
When you consider the war in Africa, it is, I'm afraid, very depressing. It's very depressing contemplating its impact in Europe and what was to come. But in Africa, it somehow seemed, even at the time, even more pointless, the loss and the death and the cost, because very little changed. Certainly on the British side, there was a good deal of shame within the colonial service about what local populations had been subjected to. This war had left a trail of utter destruction for nothing.
These are realities that Africans and the world would be wise to consider today, exactly 100 years after the end of what many believe was the war to end all war. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, Ugandan officials have stepped up measures to prevent an outbreak of the deadly Ebola virus. Ebola has infected 250 people in the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo since August, killing 180. The border between the two countries remains open, and health experts fear the virus will enter Uganda through the cross-border traffic. For VOA, Halima Atumani reports from Bundibugyo, Uganda.
The Lamia River marks the border between the Democratic Republic of Congo's Ebola-infected North Kivu province and Uganda. Despite the deadly viral outbreak, Uganda's health ministry says 20,000 people cross the border every week, putting the country at high risk. Ugandan Jane Bira goes to the DRC side at least twice a week to buy food and charcoal to sell back home.
Tunasikiaga ugonjwa iko.
We have heard the disease is there, but we have to go out and trade. We're only a little scared because we've never seen anyone fall ill with Ebola where we go. We buy the merchandise and we leave.
When Bira and others cross into Uganda, they get checked at screening points by healthcare workers and volunteers like Boaz Valimaka.
So we have the hand washing, then disinfecting the feet and screening, then we allow somebody to pass.
While no Ebola cases have yet been detected in Uganda, it can take up to 3 weeks for symptoms to appear. The virus causes a severe hemorrhagic fever that kills at least half the people who become infected. Even with border screenings, Butoko Town Council Head John Kandore says they worry someone with Ebola could slip through.
Somebody who is coming from Congo, we don't check with him with the hands. Once he comes to buy things, he buy and go. And the money, sometimes we have been fearing it to get.
Uganda's health ministry is stepping up preventive measures by deploying an experimental Ebola vaccine for healthcare and frontline workers along the border. Jane Ruth Acheng is Uganda's health minister.
Currently, in Uganda, we have 2,100 doses of the vaccine available at the national medical stores, and preparations are in high gear, including training of health workers that are to be targeted.
A 2007 Ebola outbreak in Uganda, in the border town of Bundibugyo, infected 149 people, killed 37, and took several weeks to be contained. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Bundibugyo, Uganda.
And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports. And for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with football. Esperance are the winners of this year's African Champions League. Saad Bagui was the unlikely two-goal star as Esperance of Tunisia defeated Egyptian side Al Ahly 3-0 to win a third CAF Champions League title. Anis Badri completed the scoring to give Esperance a 4-3 aggregate victory. They had lost the first leg 3-1 with Ahle converting two controversial penalties. A dominant performance by Esperance ended a 10-match winless run against Ahle in CAF competitions that stretched back to July of 2011. Esperance, champions in 1994 and 2011, will now take part in December's Club World Cup in the United Arab Emirates. Elsewhere, Kenya's Football Federation, FKF, has condemned the Confederation of African Football, CAF, decision to reinstate Equatorial Guinea to the Women's Africa Cup of Nations. FKF plans an appeal to the Court of Arbitration of Sport. Equatorial Guinea had been excluded by CAF in October for fielding an ineligible player. On Wednesday, CAF reversed the decision following an appeal from Equatorial Guinea, who were restored to the finals in place of Kenya. The news of the successful appeal came just as Kenya drew 1-1 with Ghana in a friendly on Wednesday. As it stands, the two-time winners Equatorial Guinea will be in Group B for the finals that are due to begin on November 17th. They would open their campaign against Zambia on November 18th before facing South Africa and defending champions Nigeria. Should Equatorial Guinea finish in the top three at the Nations Cup in Ghana, they would not qualify for next year's World Cup in France after ruling by FIFA in 2017. FIFA expelled Equatorial Guinea from the 2019 Women's World Cup in France for fielding 10 ineligible players and using forged documents. And in athletics, Kipchoge and Cherono are named Ames-based marathon runners for 2018. The World Running Organization, the Association of International Marathons and Distance Races, AIMS, named Kenya's Eliud Kipchoge and Gladys Cherono as the male and female winners of the AIMS Best Marathon Runner Awards for 2018. The AIMS Athletes Nomination Committee described Kipchoge and Cherono as the outstanding candidates for the award based on their performance over the past 12 months. Kipchoge is undefeated in the marathon in 2018, winning in London and Berlin. His victory in Berlin was a world record of 2 hours, 1 minute and 39 seconds, taking 78 seconds off the previous record, the biggest single improvement on the world record for more than 50 years. Cherono won the Berlin Marathon in a world-leading time of 2 hours, 18 minutes and 11 seconds. She finished fourth at the London Marathon earlier in the year. Meanwhile, Eliud Kipchoge was also named the UN Personality of the Year in Kenya. He was named for exhibiting extraordinary accomplishment that involves initiative, integrity, and courage. Not only did Kipchoge exhibit these qualities when breaking the world record, but also for his work on combating HIV/AIDS. Kipchoge, who is the 2016 Rio Olympic Marathon champion, was feted during the UN's 73rd anniversary celebrations at UN's offices in Gilgir, Nairobi. The 33-year-old is among three Kenyan athletes nominated for the 2018 Male World Athlete of the Year. Finally, the Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers, Cameroon 2019, resume this week. On Friday, South Sudan hosts Burundi in Juba, Egypt play Tunisia in Alexandria, Morocco play Cameroon in Casablanca. Then on Saturday, South Africa hosts Nigeria, Comoros play Malawi, Uganda hosts Cape Verde in Kampala, Gabon play Mali, Namibia play Guinea-Bissau, while Equatorial Guinea tussle it with Senegal, and Gambia will play Benin, while Seychelles will host Libya. And that's it for this edition of Netherlands Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports Nightline, Africa Sports.
I always wanted to be a songwriter. You know, write great music, perform it around the world.
And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. And you'll be hearing from Lyra, We Feel Good, P Square featuring Don Jazzy with Collabo, Sheba with Bira Nange. We'll be right back.
Every day I wanna wear a smile upon my face. I wanna feel the joys of the day. Everything that
na collab. Yeah. She wants some collab. I can sing for you, you can sing for me. Yeah. She says she wants some collab. She need them badly, be like Tornado. She talks, say how they play like Ronaldo. The thing they sweet her like Don Jose Minado.
Jay-Z Mulambo, oh, Lulikwe wale unamba, kuhunyira
Just heard Sheba with Bira Nange, Salty Soul with Sura Yako. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Today, world leaders gathered in Paris, France, to commemorate the 100-year anniversary of the signing of the armistice agreement in 1918. The armistice agreement brought to an end a devastating four-year war called the First World War, or in Britain, the Great War. It caused so much devastation in Europe, and many young lives were lost. And when the war ended, it was of great joy throughout Europe. The next step after the armistice agreement was signed was to convene the Versailles Peace Conference, which sets the terms of the peace agreement between the Allied powers and the Central powers led by Germany. And up to that time, up to now, not much credit has been given to the role played by French and colonial African forces in the war. It's only recently that President Emmanuel Macron of France began to acknowledge the role played by French African troops in the war, and their role was very vital. In fact, France brought in its French African troops to help in the occupation of the German territory, which was the heartland of its industrial base. And it was that occupation of French territory, of German territory, by African, black African troops that was exploited by Corporal Adolf Hitler and whipped up nationalism in France. But the war also touched the African continent itself, because the Allied powers, mainly France and Great Britain, fought against the then German territories on the African continent, like Togoland, Cameroon, Tanganyika, and Southwest Africa. And many English-speaking African troops helped in the war, although many of them were never recognized in the role that they played. The Versailles Peace Conference also set up certain elements which were of great benefit to the African people at a later stage. President Woodrow Wilson, one of the four great powers at the time, came to the conference determined to push forward the idea of the self-determination of peoples. This was not an appealing concept to the president of France, Clemenceau, but Woodrow Wilson pushed it. Of course, when he discovered later on that it was not easy to determine who determined self-determination, he regretted it. But the concept of self-determination found its way later on in the United Nations Charter after the Second World War. And that was the principle that many Africans used to gain their independence. The other issue which showed the climate of the times was that the Japanese delegation proposed at the Versailles Conference that racism should be banned. Both Clement Attlee of United Kingdom, Clemenceau of France, and Woodrow Wilson laughed at him and said there is no way they can ban racism. Again, it had to wait for the crucial, the devastation of the Second World War with the Holocaust for the great powers to agree that racism has no place in the lives of human beings, and therefore adopted the Human Rights Charter and the Human Rights Commission, and that too appeared in the United Nations Charter. The conference also determined to create what was called mandated territories. That is, those territories which were captured from Imperial Germany. Togoland was assigned to France. Cameroon was assigned to both Britain and France. Tanganyika was assigned to the United Kingdom. And regrettably, Southwest Africa was assigned to the Union of South Africa, the predecessor to Apartheid South Africa. Later on, Apartheid South Africa absorbed Southwest Africa until the liberation of what we call Namibia today. So these were all the elements which affect Africa, even though the celebration today is being focused on the European territory. I think Africans should bear in mind that even though at times they are ignored, there are times when they can benefit from some international agreements. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Zainab Abdel Rahman, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, to make a difference in life, you don't have to be brilliant, rich, beautiful or perfect. You just have to care. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.